hitting at the back to her shoulders. A bright, mentally agile young woman, Carol has been an injection crystal meth user and heroin addict since she ran away from home at age 15. The Stanley is her first stable domicile after 5 years on the streets. These days, she is active in promoting harm reduction and in supporting fellow addicts. She has attended international conferences, and her writings have been quoted by addiction experts. During a methadone appointment, she explains what she cherishes about the crystal meth experience. She speaks nervously and rapidly and fidgets incessantly, effects that result from her long-standing stimulant habit and likely from the early-onset hyperactivity disorder she had before she ever used drugs. As befits a street-educated child of her generation, Carol's every second word seems to be like or whatever. When you do like a good hit or whatever, you get like a cough or whatever, like a warm feeling. You really feel a hit, start breathing hard or whatever, she says. Kind of like a good orgasm if you're a more sexual person. I never really thought of it that way, but my body still experiences the same physical sensations. I just don't associate it with sex. I get all excited, whatever you're into. I like playing with clothes, or I like going out at night in the West End when there's not a whole lot of people. Walking down back alleys, singing to myself. People leave stuff out. I look for what I can find. Scavenging. And it's all so interesting. The addict's reliance on the drug to reawaken her dulled feelings is no adolescent caprice. The dullness is itself a consequence of an emotional malfunction not of her making. The internal shutdown of vulnerability. From the Latin word vulnerare, to wound, vulnerability is our susceptibility to be wounded. This fragility is part of our nature and cannot be escaped. The best the brain can do is to shut down conscious awareness of it when pain becomes so vast or unbearable that it threatens to overwhelm our capacity to function. The automatic repression of painful emotion is a helpless child's prime defense mechanism and can enable the child to endure trauma that would otherwise be catastrophic. The unfortunate consequence is a wholesale dulling of emotional awareness. Everybody knows there is no fineness or accuracy of suppression, wrote the American novelist Saul Bellow in The Adventures of Augie March. If you hold down one thing, you hold down the adjoining. Intuitively, we all know that it's better to feel than not to feel. Beyond their energizing subjective charge, emotions have crucial survival value. They orient us, interpret the world for us, and offer us vital information. They tell us what is dangerous and what is benign, what threatens our existence and what will nurture our growth. Imagine how disabled we would be if we could not see or hear or taste or sense heat or cold or physical pain. Emotional shutdown is similar. Our emotions are an indispensable part of our sensory apparatus and an essential part of who we are. They make life worthwhile, exciting, challenging, beautiful, and meaningful. When we flee our vulnerability, we lose our full capacity for feeling emotion. We may even become emotional amnesiacs, not remembering ever having felt truly elated or truly sad. A nagging void opens, and we experience it as alienation, as profound ennui, as the sense of deficient emptiness described above. The wondrous power of a drug is to offer the addict protection from pain while at the same time enabling her to engage in the world with excitement and meaning. It's not that my senses are dulled. No, they open, expanded, explained a young woman whose substances of choice are cocaine and marijuana. But the anxiety is removed and the nagging guilt and... yeah. The drug restores to the addict the childhood vivacity she suppressed long ago. Emotionally drained people often lack physical energy, as anyone who has experienced depression knows, and this is a prime cause of the bodily weariness that beleaguers many addicts. There are many more. Dismal nutrition, a debilitating lifestyle, diseases like HIV, hepatitis C, and their complications, disturbed sleep patterns that date back in many cases to childhood, another consequence of abuse or neglect. "I just couldn't go to sleep ever," says Maureen, a sex trade worker and heroin addict. "I never even knew there was such a thing as a good sleep until I was 29 years old." Like Thomas De Quincey, who used opium to sustain through 24 hours the L-strooping animal energies, present-day addicts turn to drugs for a reliable energy boost. "I can't give up cocaine," a pregnant patient named Celia once told me. "With my HIV, I have no energy. The rock gives me strength." Her phrasing sounded like a morbid reconfiguration of the psalmist's words, "He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved." "I enjoy the rush, the smell, and the taste," says Charlotte, longtime cocaine and heroin user, pot smoker, and self-confessed speed freak. "I guess I've been smoking or doing some form of drugs for so long. I don't know. I think, what if I stopped? Then what? That's where I get my energy from." "Man, I can't face the day without the rock," says Greg, a multi-drug addict in his early 40s. "I'm dying for one right now." "You're not dying for it," I venture. "You're dying because of it." Greg is tickled. "Nah, not me. I'm Irish and half Indian." "Right. There are no dead Irish or dead Indians around." From Greg, more jollity. "Everyone has to go sometime. When your number comes up, that's it." These four don't know it, but beyond illness or the inertia of emotional and physical exhaustion, they are also up against the brain physiology of addiction. Cocaine, as we shall see, exerts its euphoric effect by increasing the availability of the reward chemical dopamine in key brain circuits, and this is necessary for motivation and for mental and physical energy. Flooded with artificially high levels of dopamine triggered by external substances, the brain's own mechanisms of dopamine secretion become lazy. They stop functioning at anywhere near full capacity, relying on the artificial boosters instead. Only long months of abstinence allow the intrinsic machinery of dopamine production to regenerate, and in the meantime, the addict will experience extremes of physical and emotional exhaustion. Aubrey, a tall, rangy, solitary man, now approaching middle age, is also hooked on cocaine. His face is permanently lined by sadness, and his customary tone is one of resignation and regret. He feels incomplete and incompetent as a person without the drug, a self-concept that has nothing to do with his real abilities and everything to do with his formative experiences as a child. By his own assessment, inadequacy and the sense that he was a failed human being were part and parcel of his personality before he ever touched drugs. "After grade 8, I grew up on drugs," Aubrey says. "When I turned to drugs, I found that I fit in with the other kids. Yeah, it was a big important thing to fit in. See, as a kid, when you picked somebody for a soccer game, I was always the last guy to be picked. See," he continues, "I've been in institutions a lot. I've spent a long time in a 4x8 cell, so I've been by myself a lot. And before then, too, see, I had a rough childhood, going from foster home to foster home. I was shipped off quite a bit, eh?" "At what age were you sent to foster homes?" I ask. "About 11. My father was killed, hit by a truck. My mother couldn't take care of all of us kids, and so Children's Aid stepped in. Me being the oldest, they took me out. I got two brothers. They were younger. They stayed home." Aubrey believes he was chosen for foster care because he was so hyper as a kid that his mother couldn't handle him. "I was there for 5 years. Well, not in one place. No, I got shipped around. They'd keep me for maybe a year and then they couldn't, and I had to go to another one." "How did it feel to be shunted about like that?" "It hurt me. I was feeling like I wasn't wanted. I was just a kid. It's like, I'm a kid and nobody wants me. Even in school. The nuns taught me, but I never learned to read or write or nothing. They just pushed me from one class to another. I was always disciplined for something, and they'd take me out of that class and put me in a class for 4 or 5-year-old kids. so I felt so uncomfortable. It was hard for me. I felt stupid. I'm sitting there with all these little kids around me looking at me. The teacher is teaching spelling, and they're doing it, and I can't do it. I kept it all to myself. I didn't want to talk for the longest time. I couldn't even talk to people. I stuttered. I had a hard time explaining myself. I kept it all inside me for so long. When I get hyper, I can't talk proper. Strange, the cocaine calms me down, and the pot. I smoke 5 or 6 joints a day. That relaxes me too. It takes the edge off. At the end of the day, I just lay back with it. That's just what happens. That's my life. I smoke a joint, and I go to sleep. A patient's report that a stimulant drug like cocaine or crystal meth has a calming effect is virtual confirmation that he or she has ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Shirley, in her 40s, addicted to both opiates and stimulants, and stricken with the usual roster of diseases, also confesses to a sense of inadequacy without her drugs, and sees cocaine as a life necessity. I was 13 when I first used. It took most of my inhibitions away and my uneasiness, my inadequacies. How we feel about ourselves, I guess, is a better way to put it. When you say inhibitions, what do you mean? I ask. Inhibitions, it's like the awkwardness a man and a woman feel when you first meet and you don't know whether to kiss each other, except I always felt that way. It makes everything go easier. Your movements are more relaxed, so you're not awkward anymore. No less a figure than the young Dr. Sigmund Freud was enthralled with cocaine for a while, relying on it to control his intermittent depressed moods, improve his general sense of well-being, help him relax in tense social encounters, and just make him feel more like a man. Freud was slow to accept that cocaine could create a dependence problem. Enhancing the personality, the drug also eases social interactions, as Aubrey and Shirley both testify. Usually I'm feeling down, says Aubrey. I do coke, I'm a totally different person. I could talk to you a lot better right now if I was high on cocaine. I don't slur my words. It wakes me. It makes it easier to see people. I'll want to start a conversation with somebody. I'm usually not very interesting to talk to. That's why most of the time I don't want to be with other people. I don't have that drive. I stay in my room by myself. Many addicts report similar improvements in their social abilities under the influence, in contrast to the intolerable aloneness they experience when sober. It makes me talk. It opens me up. I can be friendly, says one young man wired on crystal meth. I'm never like this normally. We shouldn't underestimate how desperate a chronically lonely person is to escape the prison of solitude. It's not a matter here of common shyness, but of a deep psychological sense of isolation experienced from early childhood by people who felt rejected by everyone, beginning with their caregivers. Nicole is in her early 50s. After 5 years as my patient, she revealed that, as a teenager, she'd been repeatedly raped by her father. She too has HIV, and the ravages of an old hip infection have left her hobbling around with a cane. I'm more social with the drug, she says. I get talkative and confident. Usually I'm shy and withdrawn and not very impressive. I let people walk all over me. Another powerful dynamic perpetuates addiction despite the abundance of disastrous consequences. The addict sees no other possible existence for himself. His outlook on the future is restricted by his entrenched self-image as addict. No matter how much he may acknowledge the costs of his addiction, he fears a loss of self if it were absent from his life. In his own mind, he would cease to exist as he knows himself. Carol says she was able to experience herself in a completely new and positive way under the influence of crystal meth. I felt like I was smarter, like a floodgate of information or whatever just opened in my head. It opened my creativity. Asked if she has any regrets about her 8 years of amphetamine addiction, she is quick to respond. Not really, because it helped bring me to who I am today. That may sound bizarre, but Carol's perspective is that drug use helped her escape an abusive family home, survive years of street living, and connect her with a community of people with shared experiences. As many crystal meth users see it, this drug offers benefits to young street dwellers. Strange to say, it makes their lives more livable in the short term. It's hard to get a good night's sleep on the street. Crystal meth keeps you awake and alert. No money for food? No need for hunger. Crystal meth is an appetite suppressant. Tired? Lacking energy? Crystal meth gives a user boundless energy. Chris, a personable man with a mischievous sense of humor, whose well-muscled arms sport a kaleidoscope of tattoos, completed a year-long prison term a few months ago and is now back on the methadone program. In the downtown East Side, he's known by the strange sobriquet Toe Cutter, which he earned, legend has it, when he dropped a sharp, heavy industrial blade on someone's foot. He continues to inject crystal meth with dogged determination. "Helps me concentrate," he says. There's no doubt he's had attention deficit disorder all his life, and he accepts the diagnosis, but he declines treatment. "His smart doctor once told me I'm self-medicating," he smirks, recalling a conversation we had years ago. Chris recently came into the clinic with a fracture of his facial bones, sustained in a street brawl over a paper of heroin. Had the blow struck an inch higher, his left eye would have been destroyed. "I don't want to give up being an addict," he says, when I ask him if it's all worth it. "I know this sounds pretty fucked up, but I like who I am." You're sitting here with your face smashed in by a metal pipe, and you're telling me you like who you are? "Yes, but I like who I am. I'm Toe Cutter. I'm an addict, and I'm a nice guy." Jake, methadone-treated opiate addict and heavy cocaine user, is in his mid-30s. With his wispy blonde facial stubble and lively body movements, and a black baseball cap pulled rakishly low over his eyes, he could pass for 10 years younger. "You've been injecting a lot of cocaine recently," I remarked to him one day. "It's hard to get away from it," he replies with his gap-toothed grin. "You make coke sound like it's some wild animal, stalking you, yet you're the one who's chasing it. What does it do for you?" "Cuts the edge off everyday life down here of dealing with everything." "What is everything?" "Responsibilities. I guess you could call it that, responsibilities. So long as I'm using, I don't care about responsibilities. When I'm older, I'll worry about pension plans and stuff like that. But right now, I don't care about nothing, except my old lady." "Your old lady?" "Yeah, I look upon the coke as my old lady, my family. It's my partner. I don't see my own family for a year, and I don't care because I've got my partner."
"So the coke is your life?"
"Yeah, the coke's my life. I care more about the dope than my loved ones or anything else. For the past 15 years, it's been part of me now. It's part of my everyday. I don't know how to be without it. I don't know how to live everyday life without it. You take it away, I don't know what I'm going to do. If you were to change me and put me in a regular style life, I wouldn't know how to retain it. I was there once in my life, but it feels like I don't know how to go back. I don't have the... It's not the will I don't have, I just don't know how."
"What about the desire? Do you even want that regular life?"
"No, not really," Jake says, quietly and sadly. "I don't believe that's true. I think deep in his heart, there must live a desire for a life of wholeness and integrity that may be too painful to acknowledge. Painful because in his eyes it's unattainable. Jake is so identified with his addiction that he doesn't dare imagine himself sober."
"It feels like everyday life for me," he says. "It doesn't seem any different from anyone else's life. It's normal for me."
"That reminds me of the frog," I tell Jake. "They say that if you take a frog and drop him in hot water, he'll jump out. But if you take the same frog, put him in water at room temperature, and then slowly heat up the water, he'll boil to death because gradually, degree by degree, he becomes used to it. He perceives it as normal."
"If you had a regular life and somebody said to you, 'Hey, you could be in the downtown East Side hustling all day and blowing $300 or $400 a day on rock,' you'd say, 'What, are you crazy? That's not for me.' But you've been doing it for so long, it's become normal for you." Jake then shows me his hands and arms, covered with patches of silvery scales on a red, inflamed field of skin. On top of everything else, his psoriasis is acting up. "Do you think you could send me to a skin specialist?" he asks. "I could," I replied, "but the last time I did, you didn't show for the appointment. If you miss this one, I won't refer you again." "I'll go, Doc. Don't worry, I'll go." I write out the prescriptions for methadone and for the dermatological creams Jake needs. We chat a little more, and then he leaves. He's my last patient of the day. A few minutes later, as I'm about to check my voicemail messages, there's a knock. I pull the door ajar. It's Jake, who made it to the front gate of the Portland but has returned to tell me something. "You were right, you know," he says, grinning again. "Right about what?" "That frog you're talking about? That's me." Chapter 4. You wouldn't believe my life story. Mate, you wouldn't believe my life story. Everything I'm saying to you is true. You think I wouldn't believe it? Serena gives me a look that's resigned and challenging at the same time. A tall native woman, with long black hair, she has a perpetually world-weary expression on her thin face. Although she's also capable of sudden mirth, even in laughter, her eyes retain their sadness. Just over 30 years old, Serena has spent almost half her life here in the downtown East Side, wired on drugs. What can you tell me, I think, that I haven't heard down here before? Later, after I hear her out, I feel humbled. Serena doesn't readily share anything about her inner life. She comes for regular methadone appointments, and every once in a while attempts to scam me for some other narcotic prescription, under the pretense of having a headache or back pain. When I refuse, she's never argumentative. "Okay," she says quietly, shrugging her shoulders. One day, 2 years ago, she appeared in my office asking for methadone to carry. That is, rather than having to drink in front of the pharmacist every morning, she wanted several days' doses in advance. "My grandmother died in Kelowna," she told me in a flat monotone. "I have to go home for the burial." Downtown East Side addicts often ask for methadone carries for illicit purposes, such as selling the substance or injecting it to get a bigger rush. Others go to the pharmacy, but instead of swallowing their whole dose, they hold some in their mouth and later spit it into a coffee cup. The expectorated methadone then becomes merchandise. Despite the risk of transmittable disease, buyers don't hesitate to drink a drug mixed with someone else's saliva. Pharmacists are expected to observe complete ingestion of the methadone they dispense, but the rule is often broken, so juice is always up for sale on the streets. "I have to verify this before I can give you the carry," I replied to Serena. "Who's your grandmother's doctor?" Nonchalantly, she gave me the name. As she sat in my office and waited calmly, I dialed the physician's office in Kelowna. "Mrs. B?" my colleague said on the speakerphone. "Oh no, it so happens she was very much alive when I saw her this morning." "You heard that," I said to Serena. No flicker of movement, not the barest sign of embarrassment registered on her face. "Well," she shrugged, getting up to leave. "They told me she was dead." I've often been struck by the childlike insouciance of my addicted patients when they lie to me. A naive manipulation like the one Serena attempted is simply part of the game, and being caught is no more shameful than being found while playing hide-and-seek. Her HIV care has been a source of struggle between us, since she habitually refuses to have her blood counts done. "I can't know what treatment you need," I explain, "if I don't know the state of your immune system." Once, in utter frustration, I tried to coerce her into having the blood tests done by threatening to withhold her methadone. A week later, I recanted. "It's not my right to force you into anything," I said by way of apology. "The methadone has nothing to do with HIV. Whether you get yourself tested or not is entirely up to you. I can only offer you my best advice. I'm sorry." "Thank you, Mate," Serena said. "I just don't want anybody controlling me." Soon afterwards, she did undergo the required tests voluntarily. And so far, her immune counts have been high enough that antiviral medications haven't been needed. The question of control is a touchy one. No segment of the population feels powerlessness more acutely than downtown Eastside drug addicts. Even the average citizen finds it difficult to question medical authority for a host of cultural and psychological reasons. As an authority figure, the doctor triggers deeply ingrained feelings of childhood powerlessness in many of us. I had that experience even years after completing medical training when I needed care for myself. But in the case of the drug addict, the disempowerment is real, palpable, and quite in the present. Engaged in illegal activities to support her habit, her very habit being illegal, she is on all sides hemmed in by laws, rules, and regulations. It occurs to me at times that, in the view of my addicted patients, the roles of detective, prosecutor, and judge are grafted onto my duties as physician. I am there not only as a healer, but also as an enforcer. Coming most commonly from a socially deprived background, and having passed through courts and prisons repeatedly, the downtown Eastside addict is unaccustomed to challenging authority directly. Dependent on the physician for her lifeline methadone prescription, she is in no position to assert herself. If she doesn't like her doctor, she has little latitude to seek care elsewhere. Downtown clinics are not eager to accept each other's problem clients. Many addicts speak bitterly about medical personnel who, they find, impose their my-way-or-the-highway authority with arrogance and insensitivity. In any confrontation with authority, be it nurse, doctor, police officer, or hospital security guard, the addict is virtually helpless. No one will accept her side of the story, or act on it, even if they do. Power comes with the territory, and it corrupts. At the Portland, I've caught myself in behaviors that I would never permit myself in any other context. Not long ago, another young Native woman was in my office, also methadone dependent and also with HIV. I'll call her Cindy. At the end of the visit, I opened the door and called to Kim, the nurse whose office is directly next to mine. Please draw blood for Cindy's HIV indices and we'll need a urinalysis as well. Several clients were sitting in chairs in the waiting area, and my words were clearly audible to all. Cindy, looking hurt, reproached me quietly. You shouldn't say that so loud. I was aghast. Back in the respectable family practice I ran for 20 years before coming to work in the downtown East Side, it would have been unthinkable for me to commit such a callous breach of confidentiality, to injure someone's dignity so brazenly. I closed the door and offered my regrets. I was loud, I agree. Very stupid of me. Yes, it was, Cindy shot back, but somewhat mollified. I thanked her for being forthright. I'm tired of everyone pushing me around, she said, as she stood up to leave. There's also a deeper source of the exaggerated power imbalance that besets doctor-patient relationships in the downtown East Side. Not unique to this neighborhood, but here, it's almost universal. Imprinted in the developing brain circuitry of the child subjected to abuse or neglect is fear and distrust of powerful people, especially of caregivers. In time, this ingrained wariness is reinforced by negative experiences with authority figures such as teachers, foster parents, and members of the legal system or the medical profession. Whenever I adopt a sharp tone with one of my clients, or display indifference or attempt some well-meant coercion for her benefit, I unwittingly take on the features of the powerful ones who first wounded and frightened her decades ago. Whatever my intentions, I end up evoking pain and fear. For all these reasons, and more, Serena's instinct is to guard her inner world from me. Her asking for help today owes something to the trust established between us, but even more, to her present despair. Is there anything you can give me for depression? She begins. My grandmother in Kelowna died 3 months ago. I've been thinking of going away to be with her. Killing yourself? Not killing myself, just taking some pills so That's killing yourself.
I don't call it that. Just going to sleep. Not waking up again.
Serena looks crushed and disconsolate. This time, the loss of her grandmother is real.
Please tell me about her, I say.
She was 65. She raised me from when my mother delivered me and left the hospital right away. The social worker had to phone my grandmother and tell her that if she didn't come and sign papers, I'd be put into a foster home. Throughout the entire discussion that follows, Serena's voice is grief-stricken, choked and weepy. Her tears stop flowing, only intermittently.
Then she raised my daughter from a year old.
Serena has a child, now 14 years old, born to her when she herself was 15. Serena's mother, in her 40s and also a patient of mine, was 16 when she abandoned her newborn. She has a room with her boyfriend in the same Hastings Hotel where Serena lives.
Where's your daughter now?
With my Aunt Gladys. I guess she's doing all right. After my grandmother died, she started getting into speed and everything like that.
She raised me.
She raised my brother Caleb and my sister Devana. My first cousins, actually, but we grew up like brother and sister.
What kind of a home did she give you?
She gave me a perfect home until I left to find my mother. That's how I came down here, to look for my mom.
What this poor woman calls a perfect home becomes devastatingly clear as she continues her narrative.
Had you not met your mother before?
Never.
Had you used before?
Not till I got down here to find my mother.
Apart from the movement of her right hand as she dabs her eyes, Serena sits motionless. The sunlight streaming into the office through the window behind her leaves her face in merciful obscurity.
I had my daughter when I was 15. He was my auntie's boyfriend, whatever. He was molesting me, and if I said anything, he vowed to beat my auntie.
I see.
Mate, you would not believe my life story. Everything I'm saying to you is true.
You think I would not believe it?
In the brief silence that follows, I recollect how ever since that fictitious report of her grandmother's death 2 years ago, I have dismissed Serena as a manipulator, a drug seeker. I am prone to that human but inhumane failing of defining and categorizing people according to our interpretation of their behaviors. Our ideas and feelings about a person congeal around our limited experience of them and around our judgments. In my eyes, Serena was reduced to an addict who inconvenienced me by wanting more drugs. I didn't perceive that she was a human being suffering unimaginable pain, soothing it, easing it in the only way she knew how. I'm not always stuck in that blind mode. I move in and out of it, depending on how I am doing in my own life. I'm more subject to deadening judgments and definitions that restrict my view of the other when I'm tired or stressed, or most especially when, in some way, I'm not conducting myself with integrity. At such times, my addict clients experience the power imbalance between us most acutely.
I was 15 years old when I came down here to Hastings, Serena goes on. I had $500 in my pocket I'd saved for food until I caught up with my mom. It took me a week to find her. I had about $400 left. When she found that out, she stuck a needle in my arm. The $400 was gone in 4 hours.
And that was your first experience with heroin?
Yes.
A long silence ensues, broken only by the throaty, weeping sounds Serena is trying to suppress.
And then she sold me to a fucking big fat huge motherfucker while I was sleeping. These words are uttered with the helpless, plaintive rage of a child. She's my mom. I love her, but we're not close. The one I call mom is my grandmother, and now she's gone. She was the only one who cared whether I lived or died. If I died today, nobody would give a damn. I need to let her go. I'm holding her back.
Serena can see by my look that I don't follow.
I am not letting her go, she explains. In our tradition, we have to let the spirits go. If not, they're still with us, stuck. I suggest that it's almost impossible for her to find release, since she felt her grandmother was the only one who'd ever loved, accepted, and supported her. But what if you found someone else who really loved you and cared for you? There is no one else. There is none. Are you sure of that? Who? Myself? God? I don't know. Both, perhaps. Serena's voice breaks with grief. You know what I think about God? Who is this God that keeps the bad people behind and takes away the good people? How about yourself? How about you? If I was strong enough for that, I'd let her go. I have a drug problem, and it's hard for me to help myself. I've tried so many times, Mate. Tried and tried. I've quit for 4, 5, 6 months, a year, but I always end up coming back. This is the only place I know where I feel safe. Here in Canada, our home and native land, the reality is that the downtown East Side, afflicted by addiction, illness, violence, poverty, and sexual exploitation, is the only spot where Serena has any sense of security. Serena has known two homes in her life, her grandmother's house in Kelowna, and one or another ramshackle hotel on East Hastings. I'm not safe in Kelowna, she says. I was molested by my uncle and my grandfather, and the drug is keeping me from thinking about what happened. And my grandfather was telling my grandmother to tell me to come back and to forgive and forget. If you want to come back to Kelowna and talk about it in front of the whole family, you can. Talk about fucking what? What? Everything is over and done with already. There is no turning back. He can't forget and change what he did to me. My uncle can't change what he did to me. The sexual abuse began when Serena was 7 years old and persisted until she gave birth to her child at 15. All the while she was looking after her younger siblings. I had to protect my brother and sister, too. I'd hide them in the basement with 4 or 5 bottles of baby food. They were still in diapers. When I was 11 years old, I tried to refuse my grandfather, but he said that if I didn't do exactly what he told me, he was going to do it to Caleb, too. Caleb was only 8 then. Oh, Jesus, escapes from my lips. It's a blessing, I suppose, that after all these years working in the downtown East Side, I'm still capable of being shocked. And your grandmother didn't protect you? She couldn't. She was drinking so much until she quit. She began drinking every morning. She was drinking until my daughter was born. Years later, Caleb was killed, beaten and drowned by 3 cousins after a drinking bout. I still have trouble believing my brother is dead, too, Serena says. We were so close when we were kids. So this was the perfect home Serena grew up in, under the care of a grandmother who no doubt loved her grandchild, but was utterly unable to defend her from the predatory males in the household or from her own alcoholism. And that grandmother, now deceased, was Serena's sole connection to the possibility of sustaining, consoling love in this world. Have you ever talked with anyone about this? In the downtown East Side, this is almost always a rhetorical question. No, can't trust anybody. Can't talk to mom. Me and my mom don't have a mother and daughter life. We live in the same building. We don't even see each other. She walks right by me. That hurts me large. I've tried everything. There's no point. I've tried so many years to see if my mom would get close to me, and the only time she gets close to me is if I have some dope or money in my pocket. It's the only time she'll say, "Daughter, I love you." I wince. The only time, Mate. The only time. I have no doubt that if Serena's mother spoke about her life, an equally painful narrative would emerge. The suffering down here is multi-generational. Almost uniformly, the greatest anguish confessed by my patients, male or female, concerns not the abuse they suffered, but their own abandonment of their children. They can never forgive themselves for it. The very mention of it draws out bitter tears, and much of their continued drug use is intended to dull the impact of such memories. Serena herself, speaking here as the wounded child, is silent about her own guilt feelings regarding her neglected daughter, now a crystal meth user. Pain begets pain. Let those who would judge either of these women look to themselves. As always, when I spend an unexpectedly long time with a patient, the waiting room crowd erupts in noisy protest.
"Hurry up!" someone shouts coarsely. "We need our juice too!"
All of Serena's hurt and rage now explode out of her in a full-throated, "Shut the fuck up!" I poke my head out the door to calm the anxious multitude. I agree to prescribe Serena an antidepressant, explaining that it may or may not work, and may or may not cause side effects, depending on a person's particular physiology. And I tell her we can try another one if this one doesn't work. I hand her the prescription, and search in my heart to find compassionate words, words that may help soothe the anguish Serena bears in hers. And the words come, haltingly at first. "What happened to you is truly horrible. There is no other word for it, and there is nothing I can say that comes even close to acknowledging just how terrible, how unfair it is for any being, any child, to be forced to endure all that. But no matter what, I still don't accept that things are hopeless for any human being. I believe there is a natural strength and innate perfection in everyone, even though it's covered up by all kinds of terrors and all kinds of scars. It's there. I wish I could find it," Serena says, in a voice so choked and quiet, I am reading her lips to make out the words. "It's in you. I see it. I can't prove it to you, but I see it. I've tried to prove it to myself, and I failed. I know. You've tried, and it didn't work, and you're back here. It's very difficult. There ought to be a lot more support." Finally, I tell Serena that, to the depressed person, everything looks absolutely hopeless. That's what it means to be depressed. "We'll see how you do with the medication. Let's talk again in 2 weeks." And here is where I'm humbled. I'm humbled by my feebleness in helping this person. Humbled that I had the arrogance to believe I'd seen and heard it all. You can never see and hear it all, because, for all their sordid similarities, each story in the downtown East Side unfolded in the particular existence of a unique human being. Each one needs to be heard, witnessed, and acknowledged anew, every time it's told. And I'm especially humbled, because I dared to imagine that Serena was less than the complex and luminous person she is. Who am I to judge her for being driven to the belief that only through drugs will she find respite from her torments? Spiritual teachings of all traditions enjoin us to see the divine in each other. Namaste, the Sanskrit holy greeting, means the divine in me salutes the divine in you. The divine? It's so hard for us even to see the human. What have I to offer this young native woman whose 3 decades of life bear the compressed torment of generations? An antidepressant capsule every morning, to be dispensed with her methadone, and a half an hour of my time once or twice a month. Chapter 5. Angela's Grandfather. With her straight bearing, oval face, dark eyes, and long black hair falling in waves to her shoulders, Angela McDowell is a Coast Salish princess living the life of an exile in the downtown East Side. A long horizontal scar mars her left cheek. "A girl cut me up when I moved into the Sunrise," she tells me in a matter-of-fact tone. She's always late for appointments, if she makes them at all. Often she endures withdrawal for a few days without methadone before she comes in for her prescription, or she shoots up with street heroin. A poet, Angela carries in her purse a pink notebook with a coiled wire spine. On each page, in finely articulated handwriting, are naive rhymes of hope and loss, desolation and possibility. Some, I feel, are more authentic than others. "One day with this addiction we fight, we all will win and see the light," she vows at the end of a poem about a life of abject drug-seeking. I have my doubts. Are these her true feelings, or is she writing what she believes to be the appropriate sentiment? Yet I can tell she's been somewhere real, and the truth she glimpsed there lends her authority. The joy she experienced long ago is present in her world-illuminating smile. When her lips part to laugh or smile, she reveals two rows of perfect white teeth, remarkable in this corner of the world. Her eyes light up, the tension lines in her face soften, and her scar grows faint. "Healing is in me," she tells me one day. "I've heard the voices of the ancient ones. I had a really powerful spirit as a child." Angela was brought up, along with her brothers and sister, by her grandfather, a great shaman of her tribe. He was the last surviving McDowell in his family. All his brothers and cousins and uncles and aunts were killed, so my grandfather was sent off to a boarding school to be raised from a very young boy, grew up, married my grandmother, and had all of his children, 11 girls, 3 boys. He carried the spirit from all of our ancestors. Every native reserve has its own powers, spirits. We, the Coast Salish, we carry the gift of, I don't know how to say it, we almost can predict death. We see spirits, we see beyond, we see the other side. She shakes her head as if countering a misunderstanding on my part. It's not like seeing a clear picture. More like when you see something from the corner of your eye. This is a gift I've been handed down. A year before Angela's grandfather died, when Angela was 7, he set out to discover which of his descendants would continue to bear the gift. He had to prepare us for his death and see which one of us was chosen. Every day for a year, we went to the river, the same spot, and had a cedar bath, all the children. The writer, cultural commentator, addict, and bank robber Stephen Reed has explained to me that the spirit bath with cold water and cedar leaves is a sacred ceremony of the Coast Salish. Now serving out a long jail sentence at William Head Prison on Vancouver Island, he studies with a visiting Salish elder and feels highly honored to be allowed to take part in the spirit bath. In both Stephen and Angela's telling, it sounds like a grueling ritual, the purpose of which is spiritual cleansing. At 5 o'clock in the morning, later in the winter, the old man and his wife led the children down to a stand of cedar trees by the riverside. Summer and winter, the children lay by the bank, stripped naked. The shaman chanted as their grandmother tore small branches from places where the rising sun was shining on trees. Then, in absolute silence but for the rustling of the leaves and the murmuring of the stream, she dipped the boughs in the cold, rushing water. She bathed the children, brushing their bodies with the leaves. "They washed us off and cleansed us and strengthened us for our adult lives," says Angela, "to prepare us so we don't suffer broken bones, and so, when we're sick, we don't be sick for very long. And it's also a way for my grandfather to find out which one of us children is strong enough to carry on the spirituality. All of our ancestors are brought into the chosen one." "How does he find out?" "You're in ice-cold water, and it feels like they're scraping your skin off you. It is not a fun thing for a little kid. We didn't believe what he was telling us it was for. But soon enough, I could hear drums, native drums. After a while, that's what soothed me. That's what I listened to. As my grandfather was praying and my grandmother was giving me the bath, I could hear drums. It was so cold, and we had to lie still. I decided the only way I could get through it was not to pay attention to what my body was feeling. I would just lie there, listening to the drums, and let them do it. As time went on and it snowed, I began to hear singing. Quiet, calm, beautiful singing in a language I'd never heard before. It was native music. What was strange was that I didn't know how to speak Coast Salish at that time, but here I was, singing along. I listened to Angela with fascination, alloyed with a vague longing. It's a sense of lost connection with past generations. I had no grandparents in my life. She is steeped in tradition and the spirit world. She's heard the voices of the ancients. I read the ancients, but hear only my own thoughts. "Where is the song coming from?" the shaman asked Angela one day when he observed his wife brushing the child with the cedar leaves and saw that she, the little girl, did not suffer. She was transported, he knew, and could now be his guide. The two of them walked slowly along the trail by the river, leaving Angela's brothers and sister and grandmother until they were completely alone. And there, in a clearing, they sat, the shaman and his young granddaughter, and listened to the voices of the dead of their tribe. The dead of many generations keened and lamented and sang of their lives in an ancient tongue and told their stories and how they had worked, struggled, and died since the coming of the white people, and even before. Angela received the stories and the teaching. I see it in her. I've witnessed her speaking words of compassion and solace to other addicts in my office. I was also impressed by the quiet confidence with which she took the stage at a public event at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Library. I was giving a talk on addiction. I'd invited Angela to read her poetry, and as usual, she arrived late. When I introduced her, she strode purposefully to the podium from her place at the back. Unhurriedly, she surveyed the audience of 300 people, and, as if it was a natural everyday practice for her, recited her works in a clear, resonant voice. It was a moving performance, rewarded with long and warm applause from her listeners. That clearing by the river remains Angela's place of greatness, even though her connection with it was obscured by abuse later in her childhood. She has run far away from it, and doesn't know if she'll ever return. No keeper of sacred tribal lore now. She lives in the downtown east side as a cocaine-wired hustler and back-alley courtesan. "Blow for your dough, play for your pay," she says in a poem. But her joyous smile and patrician air of authority are born of her deep knowledge that such a place exists and that she has been there and heard the voices. They speak to her through all her misery. They still help her seek herself. "Mirror of my inner self, what do others see?" Angela asks in one of her verses. "Is it the truth in my heart or human vanity? And what do I see?"
Chapter 6. Pregnancy Journal. This is the brief account of a pregnancy and the birth of an opiate-dependent infant to an addicted mother. Despite her determination to face down her demons, the mother will not be able to keep the child. Her resources will not be adequate, and neither her pleas to the God voice in her heart nor the support we at the Portland can provide will suffice to help her carry out her sacred intention to be a parent. June 2004. I dash up to the fifth floor, where Celia is reported to be completely out of control and threatening to leap out the window. No idle threat, that. People have done it before. The reverberations of wall-piercing yells reach me in the stairwell, two stories below, as I race toward the din. I find Celia rampaging barefoot over broken glass, bleeding from several small cuts. The floor glitters with shards of shattered television screen, drinking glasses, and crockery, lit up by a midday sun that throws its beams into the room at a sharp angle. The eviscerated TV console lies in the hall. Splattered food drips from the walls and from fragments of wooden chairs. Clothing is strewn all about. On the kitchen counter, a small espresso machine gurgles and sizzles, filling the air with the pungent, acidic aroma of burnt coffee. A few blood cake syringes rest on the table, the one piece of furniture still intact. Celia stomps about, bellowing in a voice that's only semi-human, raspy, high, and grating. Tears stream down her cheeks from her reddened eyes, and quiver in droplets on her chin. She's wearing a dirty flannel nightgown. It is an unearthly scene to behold.
"I fucking hate him! Shitty, goddamn fucking bastard!"
Seeing me, Celia slumps down on the ragged mattress in the corner. I kick aside a pile of towels and hunch against the balcony window. For now, there is nothing to say.
As I await some sign that she's ready for contact, I read the prayer she's written on the wall above her cot. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds and whose breath gives life to all the world around me, hear our cry, for we are small and weak. It ends with a plea. Help me make peace with my greatest enemy, myself. June 2004, next day. Celia is quiet and even serene as she waits for her methadone script. She seems bemused by my astonishment. You say your room's back to normal? Well, it's spotless. How can it be spotless? Me and my old man put it together. The guy you hate? I said I hate him, but I don't. With her soft expression, clear eyes, straight brown hair, and calm demeanor, Celia is an attractive 30-year-old woman. It is impossible to recognize in her the raging harridan I saw less than 24 hours ago. What do you suppose makes you fly off the handle like that? I ask. You were feeling upset, but there must have been some drug on board to make you that crazy. You were ripped on something. Well, yeah, coke. It's very explosive. The less dope, heroin I'm doing, the more stuff from the past surfaces. I don't know how to handle my feelings. With rock, I get triggered, more sensitive, incredibly sensitive to unresolved things in my life. Things I'm hurt about become overwhelming to the point where I go from being completely devastated to desperate to almost volcanic. It's terrifying for me. So you've still been topping up your methadone with heroin. Why? Because I want that coma state where I don't feel anything. Reflective, cogent, articulate, Celia speaks slowly, even formally, in her low, husky voice. A gap in her teeth gives her a faint lisp. What is it you don't want to feel? Every person I ever wanted to trust, I've been hurt by. I truly am in love with Rick, but for the life of me, I can't bring myself to believe that he will not betray me. It stems right back to my sexual abuse. Celia recalls being sexually exploited for the first time at the age of 5 by her stepfather. It went on for 8 years. Recently, I've been reliving the abuse in my dreams. In her nightmares, Celia is drenched in her stepfather's saliva. That was a ritual, she explains with an almost flat matter-of-factness. When I was a little girl, he would stand over my bed and spit all over me. I shudder. After 3 decades as a doctor, I sometimes believe I've heard every kind of depravity adults can inflict on the young and the unprotected. But in the downtown East Side, new childhood horrors are always being revealed. Celia acknowledges my shock with a flicker of her eyelids and a nod, and then continues. Now my old man, Rick, was with the army in Sarajevo and he has post-traumatic stress. There's me having sexual abuse dreams and waking up, and I've got him waking up screaming about guns and death. You do drugs to get away from the pain, I say after a moment, but the drug use creates more pain. We can control your opiate addiction with the methadone, but if you want this cycle to stop, you'd have to be committed to giving up the cocaine. I am. I want this more than anything. In the waiting area outside my office, the patients are getting restless. Someone screams. Celia waves her hand dismissively. I smile at her. You didn't sound too different from that yesterday.
I was a lot worse than that. I was completely insane.
The screaming resumes, this time louder.
Fuck off, you goddamn asshole! Celia shouts, her tone suddenly vicious. I'm talking with the doctor!
August 2004. I like to have music playing on the small acoustic system behind my desk. My patients, very few of whom are familiar with the classical genre, often remark that they find it a welcome, soothing surprise. Today, it's Kol Nidre, Bruch's setting of the Jewish soul's prayer for atonement, forgiveness, and unity with God. Celia closes her eyes.
So beautiful, she sighs.
When the music is over, she stirs from her reverie and tells me she and her boyfriend are making plans for the future. What about your ongoing addiction? Is it creating a problem for you or him?
Well, yeah, because the whole me isn't there. You don't get the best of a person when there's an addiction, right?
Right, I concur. I know something about that myself.
October 2012.